although this is not usually my style, I would begin on a lesser note, which is that I'm very pleased to report to all of you that after long years of struggle, I've overcome my perfectionism. and this year is, and this year to some degree reflects that. One really good way of overcoming perfectionism is to sign yourself up to give a shiur before you know exactly what you're going to say, in a fairly short time in the future, which I have done this week. So, I'm warning in advance that that this is a shiur where the formulations are not final, hard challenges are welcome. If you think that the formulations aren't rigorous enough, or don't say what you ought to say, part of overcoming perfectionism is recognizing that there are times when it's important to at least begin the conversation, even if you don't think you've reached the final formulations. So I thought it was important enough to try to talk about these things, even if there was a real likelihood I would not get to what really satisfies me is the end. So let's start from the question, right? Is there a modern Orthodox way to learn Gemara? I want to begin by reading a challenge that came on. There's a listserv called Lukjed that we've referred to several times here at Jewish Educators, listserv moderated by Rabbi Shalom Berger, who spoke here last summer. And there was a long conversation in the fall about why teach Gemara. And a respondent named Kalman Newman, who according to the web works at the Israel Democracy Institute or something like that, wrote the following. He said that those respondents who take it absolutely for granted that knowing Gemara is a sine qua non for living a meaningful Jewish life have to answer why it is that until very recent times, and for most of Orthodoxy until this very day, this is not seen to be the case regarding women. It would seem, therefore, that one can be a good and committed Jew while being ignorant of Gemara, and I think that many pre-modern European Jews fit that definition. So that's a fair challenge, right? That we tend to work as a presumption that, right, that a way of learning Gemara has to be a way of learning Gemara that works for the masses, right? And we assume that that the way of learning Gemara has to be because learning Gemara is essential. That's not a given, right? We have to justify that claim, right? And his overall summary of that was the religious value of Talmud Torah. And Talmud as the pinnacle of Talmud Torah has to be dealt with in another context. Perhaps we have to ask if Jewish education is identical to Talmud Torah in the religious sense. So that's one question, right? Whether learning Gemara has to be central. Now I'm going to say that I think the answer to that question is yes, but you can't, right? You can't ignore the question. The second claim he makes is that a fascinating critique of Gemara study in the modern Orthodox world has been expressed by the late Rav Shigar. In a nutshell, he claims that modern Orthodoxy has not created a mode of study appropriate to its religious orientation, and instead bases its method of study on Haredi assumptions about the relationship between Torah and life. And that's also a very strong critique, which we have to evaluate if it's true. Right? So I want to say that the question of whether there's a modern Orthodox way to learn Gemara, you have to open up by asking two questions behind that. One is, are we trying to explain to develop a way of learning Gemara for everybody because it's essential that everybody learns Gemara? Or is there, right, or can we answer the question that this is the way to learn Gemara and not everyone has to do it? And secondly, the claim that the way in which you learn isn't an abstract question about what's the best way to understand something, but is a question that emerges out of religious orientation. Okay. Now I want to point out something else, or several other things that are wrong with the question the way I framed it originally. Is there a modern Orthodox way to learn Gemara? Because really, the first thing we should point out is that it seems to assume that there is at most one such way, and that it applies to children and adults. But there may be things that are worth studying that nonetheless should not be taught to high school students, and things that should be taught in high school that would be puerile as adult intellectual pursuits. As we talk about the way to learn Gemara, we have to make clear that it may not be that there is one way. There may be many ways. There may be ways of learning Gemara for high school students, and ways, right, and ways for adults, and ways for the elderly, ways for scholars, and ways for beginners, ways for the brilliantly creative, and ways for the doggedly determined. Right, so really, right, it may be that we should be thinking about many ways if our community is to fulfill its potential, which I see as essential to the Jewish nature of any community, which is to make a full contribution, not just how it learns Gemara, but how it contributes to the study of Talmud. Okay, so with that in mind, right, we have to distinguish between the two ways of thinking about the question. The first way of thinking about the question is there a method of learning Gemara that characterizes modern Orthodoxy? Meaning, right, if you go to a modern Orthodox community, that's the way they learn Gemara. And then there's a second way of asking the question is, are there methods of learning Gemara that are found only in modern Orthodoxy, albeit not everywhere in modern Orthodoxy? Right, those are two different questions. The answer to the first question, I think, is pretty much no. There isn't a method of learning Gemara that you can say characterizes modern Orthodox wherever you go, that's how modern Orthodox Jews learn Gemara, even if you go only to the places where modern Orthodox Jews learn Gemara. The answer to the second question, I think, is much more complicated, whether there are modes of learning Gemara that are unique to modern Orthodoxy. Now, the characteristic mode of learning Gemara in YU, which is sort of the center of Talmud study in modern Orthodoxy, I think one has to admit that, is what we call the Brisker method. And while some of the shiurim are, you might call, generic, especially those that are more halakha-oriented in the sense that they're not methodologically unique, the particular form pioneered by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Shlita and developed by my teacher of Rosenzweig and others, in which the development of multiple, subtly nuanced conceptual formulations of a legal position. I thought that when I explained their position, I should say something like that. Multiple, subtly nuanced conceptual formulations of a legal position is a self-referential sentence. Is the intellectual end of learning, is, to my knowledge, unique to modern Orthodoxy. I think that the Gush Derech, so to speak, right, or Neo-Brisk, if you want to sound more academic, I don't think that is a method that is learned anywhere else. However, I have to say that I think this is probably the only method currently unique to modern Orthodoxy. The various methods in which people study at other institutions, such as Yeshivat Chavei Torah or Malei Gilboa, or developed by individuals who headed institutions like the late Rav Shigar or Rav Brandis at Beit Marashah, to the extent that they in fact represent coherent and developed methodologies of learning under teaching, which is in at least some of these cases unclear to me. Some of them I think are just combinations of approaches taken from elsewhere. I don't think that they have had any kind of real penetration in modern Orthodoxy. The Hartman Institute, on the other hand, does have, I think, a fairly clear position, but its penetration in modern Orthodoxy is at best minimal. And as an individual, I have to say that I have deep intellectual difficulties with almost all of these methods, on grounds that I think precede the ideological, which is that I tend to think that they don't produce truth. which you can talk about whether that's an idea, that to me that precedes an ideological issue, right? That the method of learning Gemara has to produce something that is faithful to the text. And even if something is religiously effective, if I could convince people I could convince people and it was religiously effective for them to believe that every sugya in Gemara is actually a coded representation of a cookbook. Right? And you just have to understand what the term symbol really. But if you learn, Shabbos is all about souffles, and Tzachim is about ice cream, right? And it turns out that will make it really popular, and everybody will find this fulfilling, and it ties into a theology in which God wants us to be happy. Right, and God wants us to be happy, so He gives us lots of desserts. We just haven't understood this all these years. This gives me, I guess I mentioned, one of my favorite books of all time, which is a book called The Mana Machine, which argues that the Zohar, particularly the Atik Yamin section of the Zohar, is not actually a mystical text. It's really the blueprint for a nuclear-powered portable algae farm. And it proceeds to go through it line by line and explain to you. It turns out that this is slightly beyond our technology, but that's because obviously this was a book given by space aliens to Moses. You think I'm crazy, but there are crazier people than me who spend their lives doing nothing else but decoding these kinds of symbols. So maybe it's really true that Shabbos is about souffles. It seems to me at least as plausible as the notion that the Atik Yamin section, which, by the way, you may have seen Atik Yamin mistranslated as Ancient of Days, but it really means transportable one of water tanks. If you think about it, it works perfectly etymologically. And there's no reason that all the words can mean transportable one of water tanks, just as old as Ancient of Days. It's easy to understand how the misapprehension took place. But I tend to think that I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it even if it worked. I tend to think I wouldn't do it. And so by the same token, if somebody wants to argue that technical halachic discussions are actually about really deep philosophic, all technical halachic discussions are really about deeply philosophic issues, I don't find it convincing, and I'm not willing to make that the basis of methodology, whether or not it would work. This is an issue that I have addressed since high school, where in high school I wanted to write a lumdish piece called Emunah B'Ta'ut, Havi Emunah or Lo Havi Emunah, except then I said Emunah B'Ta'ut, Havi Emunah or Lo Havi Emunah, right? Whether if you believe something, if people have faith based on a mistaken premise, do we consider this faith? The specific premise that I was interested in was that a herd of pink elephants thunders down Broadway in New York City exactly at midnight on December 23rd every year for 30 seconds and then vanishes. And since only God could produce this, therefore people who believe that this is true will certainly believe in the existence of God. And the question is, if I could, however, they'd be convinced people in the existence of those elephants, would that in fact convince them? Would that be a religious good? That's the mashal. The nimshal was Torah code. Right, because there are many people going around being convinced of an existence of God because of Torah codes, which have, I still think, approximately the same factual significance as the herd of pink elephants. okay, so I want to develop a, so it matters to me very much that a Gemara methodology be one that reflects what I genuinely believe to be the intent of the text. Okay. I also think that it is important that we recognize that developing unique modern Orthodox ways of learning Gemara, one of the things that we should be careful is that this not cut us off from what I believe is a necessary common learning conversation with what we shall call the non-modern Orthodox. Those people who are Orthodox but don't identify as modern Orthodox. I think it's essential that we continue having a common conversation with them about the text we learn. So I'm not interested in developing a method that ends up making us sectarian, even if it has value. I don't mean to suggest that only distinctly modern Orthodox methods are valuable, or even that they must occupy the lion's share of one's learning time. But I think that there is value in having unique methods, and I think that one of the advantages of that, which we should consider, is that it may be that certain of these methods enable a conversation with the non-Orthodox world in ways which doesn't exist currently, which I think has value as well. Okay, but what we have is in a descriptive sense, right? We really have one method right now, which is what we're calling Neo-Brisk, and in response to that, we have Rav Shugar's critique, and we have to ask the question whether this is in fact the method that best, right, or that reflects a modern Orthodox spiritual orientation. Does it justify what I believe is the inescapable religious centrality of Talmud Torah? Now, there's been a lot of what I call hand-wringing about this in various forums, especially in Israel. Why is it that not every student falls in love with Gemara, and is it really a good idea to make Gemara central to the curriculum? So I want to talk about the question of whether this method is the method that we should hang our hats on, or kippot, or whatever it is, as the modern Orthodox method through the, what I think is generally understood as the central ideological text of that position, which is Rav Soloveitchik's Isha Halakha. So in Isha Halakha, or Halachic Man, Rav Soloveitchik has a very long section, which I think is core to the understanding of the ideological justification of this position. Right? So the whole notion of Torah Lishma primarily refers to studying for the sake of the love of the Torah, that one should exert itself to determine its root principle. A person might think that Lishma means for the sake of Dveikut, of cleaving to God, and according to this opinion, one would imagine that occupying himself with songs and hymns, in particular Tehillim, the Psalms of David, the sweet singer of Israel, that arousing one love for God and a sense of his closeness is sufficient for him, and in this manner he will live a sweet and desirable life. But such is not the case. But the Midrash states that David HaMelech requested that one occupied with his poems and songs be considered the equivalent of one who studied the laws of Nigaim and Ohalot, which implies that the study of those laws, which deal with things that are not physically pleasant, right, death and disease, is superior, more valuable. And we have no evidence, and this is what I think a beautiful exegetical move, and the Midrash says that David HaMelech asked to be considered equivalent, who says that God says yes. Maybe it didn't work, right? Actually studying the Nigaim and Ohalot remains superior to studying Tehillim. This is so because the primary purpose to study is not to occupy oneself with cleaving to God, with Dveikut, but rather to understand through Torah the commandments and the laws and to know each and every matter clearly, both its general principles and its particulars. Rather, one should study those matters for the sake of the matters themselves, so that we'll comprehend them and deepen one's understanding and analytic skill, and not study them only for Dveikut, as many have mistakenly thought. Right? For example, you should study tort law, right? Damages. Right? And then you have to think about the psychology of liars. And even though he has no thought during learning from matters of Yirat Hashem, right? When you're learning, you have no religious, right? No religious intent other than learning. All learning is for the sake of the unification of the divine name. And when he tires himself in the effort to understand the law simply and clearly, certainly the Shekhinah rests upon him while he is actually learning. As the sage of the blessed memory said, the Holy Blessed One, blessed be He, now is in his world only the four cubits of halakha. Now, I quoted this as if it's from Isha Halakha, but it's actually a quote in Isha Halakha. All right? It's a nested citation. This is, right, because our salvation now goes on to tell you that the above are the words of Rav Chaim Valeshin, the outstanding student of the Vilna Gaon and founder of the Yeshiva Valeshin, which is, you all know, the progenitor of the modern Lithuanian Talmud study movement, in his book Ruach Chaim, and it seems to me that they need no commentary. Okay, that's a very powerful statement, and to me, it's core to the claim that this methodology is spiritually congenial to where we are, right, to where we are as a community. It rests on the claim that there is no reason to think of psychological consequences, habits of mind, faith or any, right, beliefs, any of those things. Thinking about any of those things in the process of Talmud Torah is a mistake, right? Because learning Torah intellectually, just intellectual understanding Torah, is all there is, and this becomes known. Right, that's what Torah Lishma means, and it's not a, right, you can't ask. It's the kind of statement that asking for a justification is by itself wrong. Right? Every system has to come to an ultimate value which can't be justified in terms of other values. That's like you need a first cause. Right? Why do you keep me filled? Fulfill the will of God. Why do you fulfill the God? Because God is good. Okay, so right, you fulfill, right, etc. There has to be a first cause. In this theology, the first cause is Torah. Torah, right, studying Torah is valuable. And that's it. Now, what is it? If the study of Torah is valuable for itself, just the understanding of Torah, so then you can understand the appeal of a method which says, you know what, this method is entirely self-contained. Right? All it does is seek to make you understand this better, and we can do it really, really well. Right? We can learn it from the highest conceptual. On the highest conceptual level, because if the culture actually takes as its premise that the pinnacle of religious achievement is Torah Lishma, meant Torah studied without looking for the question of why Torah study is, asking why Torah study is important, so then this works beautifully. So I'm interested in, first of all, the question of whether this ideology has a history, because interesting, because if you perceive this as, well, of course, that's what everybody, right, that's what everybody thought along, right, that's what Torah Lishma is, so then, you know, interesting, so why, the question of whether it's unique to modern orthodoxy or not is, no, you know, modern orthodoxy is just the epitome of the way everyone learned Gemara, and why. So the way I usually try and problematize this, yes?
I'm just not sure I exactly understand that they're saying way that you study it for its own sake.
Yeah.
Period. It seems like it's implied you study it for its own sake to act in a certain way.
Where does he talk about action?
Well, Because it's implied you're studying it to somehow understand the commandments, not just so that you intellectually understand them, but so that you, the implication of the commandments is so that you behave a certain way.
That's nice. It's not that you think that, honestly, but this is a polemic against that. Then if you're not studying for its own sake, you're studying to know what to do. And then it makes much more sense to study handbooks, right, than to study Nigaim. You're never going to do Nigaim, right? We don't have leprosy nowadays. Right, we have leprosy. We don't have Nigaim. We don't have Tzaraat. So if the goal is to find out what to do, what sense does it make to study Nigaim? Right, so I think that your question, I don't want to be harsh, right? The question is valuable because it shows how actually counterintuitive this claim is. Right? Most people assume that study for its own sake is a very hard notion, although we might justify with regard to a certain percentage of the liberal arts. Right? But the notion that the purpose of Torah study is just for itself, and to be willing to stop there and not need to put a purpose, right? So he says Dvekut, right? So you say, okay, he doesn't want Dvekut, but he really does want you to at least act that way. He just doesn't care about belief. He doesn't want any of that, right? I think Rabbi Soloveitchik says it because he's trying to justify, right? So he's trying to explain the somewhat ironically named halachic man who has no interest in halacha except as an object of study, right? Who keeps it in a sense because it would be a diminution of the value of one's study if you didn't practice it. Right? That's the way Rav Lichtenstein once framed it in a beautiful shiur, right? That the reason we do mitzvot, the reason we daven, right, even though davening is an interruption of learning, is because it was right. It just somehow seems to be a diminution of your. You're not taking your Torah seriously if you don't do it when you have to. But if you never had to do it, it wouldn't be a problem. Okay, right, I think that's the ideology. And he says it very starkly, right, because he quotes this selection from Chaim Velazhen, right, when your book is built around a quote, and you say, I'm just quoting it, and it needs no commentary, right, you're making a very strong assertion. Mm-hmm. So I've always thought this is a central moment. And, of course, central moments are always vulnerable. Like, if you stake everything on something, and then you find a flaw in the argument, right, so that's always the risk of doing it. So, yes, Andy.
So sometimes I think of Shema, Lashem, Shemaim as interchangeable, you know, and so, I mean, we're clearly not saying they are here, I mean,
right.
Shemaim would be the counter-argument here that it's actually prejudicious, Lashem, right? But here it's Lashema meaning, no, it's for its own sake, the material, the content,
yeah,
in and of itself.
Yeah, so Rabbi Lam has a book, which, called Torah for Torah's Sake, in which he traces what he understands to be the intellectual history of the term lishma. My usual shir goes the other way around, and I trace the history of shalo lishma and try and see what's left after you're done with it. What I want to do, and I confess I'm doing this for some degree of polemical shock value, is I want to just show you the quote. Because Rabbi Soloveitchik tells you this comes from Ruach Chaim, and I'm going to cheat because I gave you the long quote in English. The quote in Yishalacha in English, but trust me, it's accurate in Hebrew. And what you see in the net, what you see in source number 2 is the original quote from Ruach Chaim. Except if you go back and you look, you'll discover that there are two places in the original, these little dot dot dots in English. And in the Hebrew, right, the underlined sections are what's missing, the dot dot dots. And you discover if you look at it, gee, there's a lot missing in that quote, isn't there? Like most of it, when you read it, it looks like a consecutive quote. But when you look it up, you discover, well, there's a lot of excerpting going on here. And it's worth looking at what's missing, right? So the first time, right? If you look in the English, right, it says that the primary purpose of study is not to occupy oneself with cleaving to God, but rather to understand through God the commandments and laws, and to know in each every matter clearly both its general principles and its particulars, parentheses, now this part he left out, and also to understand the deep secrets of God's, God's nature and the analysis of his glory. So we didn't quite stop at learning halacha, just for the sake of knowing halacha and stop there. And then if you look at the next section, right? He gives you a metaphor. And he says the metaphor is somebody who enters the king's palace and he sees a treasure. And because he sees the treasure, therefore, he looks up the front and he sees there's a door to the next room. And so he goes through the door to the next room where he sees ever greater treasures. As he walks down the corridor, every time he sees a greater treasure, and that greater treasure attracts him to go through the next door, and that way he achieves the ultimate door. Now, this is not a metaphor for learning Gemara, halachic Gemara, in deeper and deeper conceptual ability. It's a metaphor, as he tells you, for eventually achieving universal understanding. It builds towards Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who understands everything from Aesop's fables to the conversations of date trees, which we'll talk about in another context later this summer, and Davar Gadol and Davar Katan. And I think that this is the key to Ish Halacha, because Rabbi Soloveitchik tells you earlier that Ish Halacha is the Baal Havayot Abaye Verava, and the Gemara tells you that in Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's curriculum that Davar Katan is Havayot Abaye Verava, and Davar Gadol is Maaseh Merkava. Right? And essentially what this metaphor is that Davar Katan is Gemara, and Davar Gadol is mysticism, right? Is ecstatic, or whatever. I'll let Rysendra give you a description of what exactly Maaseh Merkava means, which is obviously a medieval dispute as to, but it's some kind of ultimate esoteric knowledge. And the metaphor Rav Chaim Volozhin actually gives you is that Gemara is a vestibule. Right? What we call halachic Gemara is a vestibule. So I think what we have to understand out of this, right, is that the ideology of halachic man, which is an incredible book, right? It's an incredible book. I hope that many of you have tried to read it. If you haven't, you'll try again. It's an incredible book. It's one of the books that has, that in some sense made me as a religious person and continues to shape me as a religious person. But you have to understand that halachic man is distinctively modern Orthodox, in that it was developed as a modern rationalization of a preceding itself revolutionary method of learning. As Rav Soloveitchik points out in his hesped for his uncle, the Brisker method was a revolutionary phenomenon in some ways, but the Brisker method was not a theologically self-conscious revolution. Halachic man is the development of a self-conscious development of a rationalization for a method. Now that rationalization is responding to a specific idea, to a specific spiritual condition, religious orientation, as Rav Shigar would say, one which gave tremendous deference, even religious deference, to science and to the objectivity of science, and so halachic man generates a way of making the study of Torah both as rigorous and more valuable, right, than the study of science. In a classic form, it's a way, right, if God wrote two books, right, so it's a way of explaining that the book of the Bible, right. So this is a way in which the study of the second book achieves the same rigor as the study of the natural book, and becomes ultimately valuable. Particularly the emphasis on quantification, and Rabbi Soloveitchik himself, which is a very different issue, is responding to his own philosophic training, I think, and you can feel, you can see the material he learned in the University of Berlin all over. So I think that we have to recognize there that it responded brilliantly to a particular set of issues, and we have to ask the question whether the religious orientation of modern Orthodoxy and the issues it faces are the same. Because it may be that it's what was necessary then, and it brilliantly explained why it was necessary then, but it's not necessarily what the pinnacle is now. So here I want to make make a number of qualifying points. One is Dr. Schatz, Dr. David Schatz, whom many of you should be familiar with as probably the leading technical philosopher in Orthodoxy, and also a wonderful after-dinner speaker. Really wonderful after-dinner speaker. I don't want to kill all his jokes for you, but he's really very funny. I'll tell you what, I never quite got over that a great philosopher could make a joke like this at the last conference, where he said whenever he talks about Søren Kierkegaard, he always makes sure to mention his nationality when he talks to Jewish audiences, for a very simple reason. Because if you say existentialism to Jewish audiences, they tend to go, but if you say Danish... It's just fun. You have somebody like an incredible technical philosopher who's willing to make jokes like that. strings and strings of jokes like that. I aspire to his delivery. Anyway, so he said at the opening of the Soloveitchik Institute that you have the challenge of what happens when you build a monument to an innovator. Right, what does it mean to build a monument to an innovator? You can't capture the spirit of an innovator in a monument. Right? A monument freezes things, and that's a challenge. You know, so I don't want to perceive this or present this as a challenge to the Rav. I think it's a challenge of how you live up to the Rav. Right? If you see halachic man as a tremendous response to the religious orientation of the time, then you can fairly ask the question: so what would the Rav say in response to now? But the question is not what would the Rav who was educated in Berlin in the 1920s say now. What would the Rav if he had lived a life parallel to that say in response now? I think that's a fair. And I think that the point of that, I don't know that he succeeded in it, was to try and get the Soloveitchik Institute to conceive of itself as being capable of responding creatively and flexibly to circumstances, as opposed to simply being a mausoleum of the of thoughts that were really fresh once upon a time. Secondly, I want to talk about a broader. This is a more challenging thing about the question of what a community gets from its great leaders. So here I'm gonna make it. I'll get in trouble with everybody on this one. So I'll say right. So one of the theses that is popular in business now and has been imported to some degree from business into education is the best practices model. It may actually even come from, you can even get it cheaper by the dozen. It comes from some degree. Motion study was an early way of putting this into industry. And the best practices model assumes that whatever the great people do is best, and so if average people copy the great people, then they'll turn into great people. And I want to contend that in education, that is often not a good idea. So Rabbi Sender and Rabbi Avi Weinstein, who I met last week, all tell a story about a particular teacher of theirs, who one of the measures of his greatness, look, correct me if that's not true, one of the measures of his greatness was you could be giving a class, and a student would raise his hand and start ready to call on him, and he would say, "Shah!" Because he never wanted people to say wrong things in class. Because he had the thesis that if you say wrong things in class, people will remember the wrong things, not the right things. Really compelling. But you have to really know, right, what students are thinking, right? So the climactic story is when he turns to a student before he raises his hand and says, "Stop thinking that." And then the student, afterwards the student acknowledges, right? That's what I was thinking the wrong thing. Now, let's suppose that we taught...
That really happened, by the way.
Right, right.
I mean, it's not just an argument out of service. That really happened.
Right. But now let's suppose we train teachers that way. The right way to teach a class is to figure out what your students are thinking and just keep telling them, "No, stop!" Whole class in telepathy.
Actually, a lot of students would do really well at not thinking in general, right?
Pardon? And then the point is, this would be massively destructive. And this is a teacher who many students claim is the greatest teacher they ever had, right? Many great students claim, right? But it would be massively destructive if you adopted it as a universal, I think, if you adopted it as a universal teaching method. And this is true, I think, of many great teachers, that the attempt to have mediocre teachers copy great teachers doesn't even make them good teachers. It makes them teachers trying to do things they can't do. of, and I think that's probably true in many areas. So one of the questions we have to ask is whether the right way to construct, all right, to construct modern orthodoxy is to have the Rav describe what really mattered to him and have everybody try to be the Rav. I'm not sure that is necessarily the best way to the best way to build a movement, because it may be that what made the Rav great is not right, is not something that the average person should try. Present company accepted, of course. We should all. I want to make another point, which is that to be distinctively modern Orthodox, this is a variant of the recognition that Isha Halakha is a very modern, right, time-responsive work, that things that are distinctly modern Orthodox may be more traditional than that which is currently identified with Haredism. Right, that you can have it, right, it might be that a uniquely modern Orthodox method would be learning exactly the way they learned in Provence in the 13th century. Whereas the way the Haredim learn is something that's developed radically in the 20th century. That's all possible, right? So we shouldn't assume that in order to be non-Orthodox, it has to be unique, right? So the Rav pointed out that Brisk is revolutionary, right? So what happens if we decide the distinctive non-Orthodox method is Galatian or Pilpul, right? So we'll be old-fashioned, right? But we'll have, right, in that sense, but we'll be learning, what was traditional before Brisk happened. I myself, right, I don't know if I'm going to do it this summer because I have the benefit of having students back, and I don't want to bore them by doing the same thing again. But every couple of years in my summer program, I teach the introduction to the Telzer's Shiurei Da'at. And I find, if you talk about where I get my own method of learning Gemara from, right, and learning Halacha from, it's very much from the Telzer. But Telzers I meet are kind of astonished by this because I've never struck them that was an important book. So it might be, if the way I learn wins, so then we'll just be going back to Tells, which the Haredi world has largely forgotten about for various reasons. There's what's his name? Eshtas, Micah Berger, I think, who campaigns for the Tells of Derech also. Although we don't necessarily say exactly the same things about what the Tells of Derech is. So let's say, it was a sort of slightly deceptive thing in Shir over the past couple of days, so I set up this radical notion in Shir that maybe the proper way to read a sugya is to imagine that even though the sugya, if you read it straightforwardly, reads like there's a statement by Rabbi Gamliel, and then Abaye, right, if there's a contradiction between Rabbi Gamliel, that's between the Mishnah which quotes Rabbi Gamliel and the Braitha, and Abaye resolves it, and we ask a question on Abaye, so Abaye changes his mind and offers a different resolution, and we ask another question on Abaye and he changes his mind and offers another resolution. But we could think that actually Abaye's statements were about the Braithas and not about Rabbi Gamliel at all. And this was just put in by an editor. Right, and we could totally rethink about the sugya as if the sugya were actually composed by an editor and weren't a live dialogue. We're in a live dialogue of the Beit Medrash, Ravina, and Ravashi, and Abaye was never interested in the contradiction between the Mishnah and the Braita at all, and therefore Abaye is not changing his mind when you show it doesn't resolve the issue, right? Because Abaye never thought about it at all. Abaye just made this series of statements, which somebody constructed as a live, right, as if it were a live dialogue. And that seemed very radical, but it turned out to be the Pshat of the Ron. Right? The Halashon. Right, the Ram said exactly that, right? That's right. You have to realize that Abaye never said anything about Rabbi Gamliel, right? And therefore, there's no reason to reject Abaye's positions just because Gemara is an attack on him, because Abaye wasn't interested in that. Just it was a literary device to try and get Abaye into the sugya. This is the contention of probably the most comprehensive curricular attempt going on right now, which is a group called Bonayef, which argues for a very historical and geographical mode of understanding Gemara. Like the key things you have to understand are who lived when and where, and then right, and sugya are constructed along geographic lines. And that sounds very modern academic, but they claim it's the way all the Sephardi Rishonim learned. That may be true. I have really very little conception of what that's right. So we should not feel sort of insecure and say that trying to develop a modern Orthodox method means being untraditional. It might mean being very traditional, because in terms of modes of Talmud study, we're really most of the modes going on here are revolutionary. Almost everybody learns Brisk, right? And if the Rav is right, then Brisk is this late 19th century revolution, which some of historically led to fairly violent street fights in the Lushan, while people debated whether this was the method of learning that should go on. We're not, and eventually it lost, which is why it's called the Brisk Derech, otherwise it would be called the Lushan Derech. Right? But over time, the Brisk Derech won intellectually, and the Lushan Derech is a footnote in history. You know, where people don't read the Nitzir's Merome Sedef, for example, which they should. It's a great book. Yes, it is.
What was the Lushan Derech?
Who knows anymore? Right? It doesn't have any. You know, I mean, you could read. Tough to know, right? Tough to know. Read in the Meromei study. You can see what the Nitziv thought it was. The Nitziv learned the same way as Rav Itzel Voloshin. We have very little of Rav Itzel Voloshin. We have very little of Rav Chaim Voloshin. Do we really know what they learned like? Maybe it was Lake where they didn't have any style method at all and they just sat and learned all day. I don't know. Right? Yeah, everyone should. I don't know. Right? You know. We know that at some point, Rav Chaim Brisker was the young Rosh Hashiva who attracted all the students and that caused fights. But it could be that he was just highly charismatic and had nothing to do with the way he learned. We don't know. We don't know the answer to that. Okay. Now I want to say. I want to say that this is an overall way of framing it. Is that what we've talked about? Right. We can reduce the question of a way of learning to one of technique. Right. What does one do when one is learning? But I think that the Kalman Newman quote initially articulates properly. That really the question we should ask is about purposes. And that's why looking at Ish Halakha directly is important, because Ish Halakha fundamentally says that you can't ask the question of purposes. Right? And the issue is, right, that worked then, and the question is that really an ideology that is going to work, at least on a mass level, nowadays? So I think that once we start talking about justification, we can talk about two kinds of justification. The first is one that allows students to gain a particular experience or understanding, and the second is one that allows the students to form a relationship with the text. So the first one is makbid on right. If you want students to gain a particular experience or understanding, so they're going to have to learn Gemara a particular way. The second, which says the purpose of learning Gemara is to enable them to form a relationship with the text, so that will legitimate any mode of study that lets you form a relationship with the text. So the proviso that if it's sheker, then it doesn't let you form a relationship with the text, it lets you form a relationship with some kind of projection. Right? Perhaps I want you to actually form a relationship with the text. But if my goal is for you to form a relationship with it, then I don't really care, I don't have any prior conceptions as to what the intellectual modality of it is. Okay, secondly, I want to argue, why would we care about a relationship with the text? So here, now I'm a Brisker, so I'm going to make a chakira. Right? So we could care about a relationship with the text because understanding the past gives meaning to our present Jewish lives. Right? So we want to identify with Gemara because that makes us part of Jewish tradition. Or we can form a relationship with the text because understanding the past is a prerequisite for creatively developing our future Jewish lives, both as individuals and as a people. The first approach sees learning largely as a self-service. Right? I want to feel that I'm connected. And the other sees learning as a responsibility. I need to be able to contribute. Right? In other words, right, if in the second approach, so you might say that in a static and unthreatened Jewish community, right, a community where you know that pretty much the future is going to be like the past, right, so then learning Gemara may not be so important. Right. If the reason to learn Gemara is because learning Gemara is what enables you to creatively respond to the new, so then in a frozen society, it may not be so important to learn Gemara, and it may be, right, if you want to offer a radical historical thesis, that it's not a coincidence that the rise of the yeshiva roughly parallels the rise of the Haskalah. Right, that it's the reality of change that makes creative Talmud Torah necessary, and we respond to it. Necessity is the mother of Chiddush. In the second approach, arguments about methodology are not so much about how best to serve the students as about what we want Torah to look like in the future. We might teach a Gadata not because students are turned off by pure Brisker Lumdus. Some are, some aren't. And I tend to think that the real variable is that students are excited by what teachers are excited by and not excited by what teachers aren't excited by. So if you get teachers who don't like learning Bris, teaching Bris, the students will be bored. Right. And if you get the teachers who really want to be teaching Brisk and you force them to teach Agadita, all of a sudden Agadita is going to be boring. I sat in a shir where Agadita was the deathly dullest thing you could imagine because it was a duty. Right? And you could all just, you just wait for us to go back to halacha. Right? But so rather we would teach, right? We teach a Gadata because we think that students ought to live religious lives that integrate narrative and hashkafa into them, rather than being halachocentric. And conversely, we teach brisk because we genuinely see halachic man as an ideal. Right? That's why we teach the brisk and because that's what we want people to be. Those who teach Agarata think that students who care only about brisker concepts are religiously deficient, no matter how inspired they are. And those who teach only Chakirut think that students who want Agarata are infected by subjectivism. And those who think that the purpose of teach the halacha think that both the briskers and the Agaris have abandoned the discipline and responsibilities of practice for intellectual or spiritual self-indulgence. Right? So it really matters. Right? It really matters what your purposes are. So I want to suggest that the critique that Kalman Newman cites from Rav Shigar, that modern orthodoxy thinks about Torah study through a Haredi lens, is true enough as it goes. But I think the proper response is not to radically de-emphasize Talmud, but rather to develop a method and content of learning Talmud that explicitly looks to the future as well as the past. We want to develop a modern orthodox method of learning Gemara. Should be the one that will most likely contribute to the development of interpretations of Torah that will most likely yield the kind of individuals and society that we wish to produce. Okay, so now, right, so that means that the question of is there a modern orthodox way to learn Gemara really requires us to come down to some kinds of self-definition of modern orthodoxy, particularly, and what kind of self-definitions are likely to be implicated in the mode we have of learning Gemara. So I want to offer two tentative, very very abstract notions that might be central to this definition. One is that one meaning of modern orthodoxy, and here I'm trying for a really rigorous formulation, which means there'll be a lot of weasel words in it, is a deeply cautious belief in the possibility of the advancement of human knowledge. Not the inevitability of the advancement of human knowledge, or even the probability, but the possibility of the advancement of human knowledge in any and all spheres, including Torah. Now, for those of you who are immediately react, what about Yiridat HaDorot? What about the decline of the generations? So you should read or write Norman Lamb's Torah Mada, which he has a fun chapter on Yiridat HaDorot, which he called the degeneration theory, which is a nice pun, like the decline of the generations. And he goes through all the sources on this, which the best one, which I'm always grateful to Rav Rosenzweig for referring me to, is the magisterial introduction of the Netziv to Ha'amek She'elah, his commentary on the She'il Tot, which is just this incredibly beautiful essay, which takes the thesis that intellectual and spiritual achievements are inversely related in a sense, because you develop intellectual acuity in Torah in reaction to the loss of spiritual intuition. And therefore, the further we get from Sinai, the more intellectually compelling arguments get. Right, this is part of the always joke of Rosenzweig once told me that I should make my autobiography The Advantages of Being on a Low Madriga. Right, so that's really what the Nesiv Zakdama is. Right, it's all about the intellectual advantages of being on a low madriga. So I'm part of a tradition. Look, Amy. Okay, now I also want to point out that when I believe in, when I talk about the advancement of knowledge, that does not mean a belief that there are new ideas, because knowledge advances if more people believe the truth and fewer people believe the false. Right? So talking about the advancement of knowledge, particularly in Torah, it doesn't have to mean that all of a sudden somebody comes up with an idea that nobody else did. It might just mean that somebody has a slightly better understanding of an idea that everyone believes, or it might be that an idea which used to be held by 5% of the population is now held by 95% of the population. Now, we'd all consider this, you know, let's take an example. I think this is an ahistorical example, and we'll talk about that later. But let's suppose that we believe that the Earth is round and not flat. Now, it happens that in history there have always been people who believe the world was round, and there may always have been people who believe the Earth is flat, although that's much more problematic. But let's suppose that once upon a time, this I think is never true, but let's suppose once upon a time 95% of the people believed the world was flat, and 5% thought it was round. And now 95% of the people think the world is round, and 5% think it's flat. Guess what? Human knowledge has advanced. Right, if that were true. And that can be true in Torah as well. Right, if it turns out that 500 years ago only 5% of people believed the really important Torah idea, or understood it well, and now 95% of people believe it, that's progress. And I think that that's part of modern Orthodoxy, again, is this deeply cautious belief. Right? Very, very deeply cautious, because it's wedded, as we'll talk, right, to a reverence for tradition. But it doesn't see us as inevitable decline in every area of knowledge. Right? We're not always yearning for a golden age where people knew everything. And we think we could, right? We think we can make progress even in Torah in a certain sense. Okay, right. So in this, we can talk about the way the Gemara and the Gemara sets up the possibility of the rediscovery of minority opinions. We don't have time to do that in depth, but I gave you the sources. You can see that that this tension is expressed beautifully because you can, right? The purpose of preserving minority opinions can be threefold. It can be just to tell you why they're wrong. It can be so that if you come up later and think it's a new idea, we can say, now we already proved that wrong in the past, you can't do that. Or it can be because sometimes, you know what, we preserve the idea because later, right, people will decide that's true.
What's different in the first two?
Well, the first one is just, I think, an intellectual thing, right? You should know what, right? We just say, explain why it's wrong. The second is a formal legal thing. In case you want to claim, look, I have a new idea which you haven't considered before, we can say, no, we already paskined against that. Right, formally, so, right? So ask and answer. There's a third possibility, which is that you preserve all ideas because someday that somebody might decide they're true or necessary, and we're not going to get into the pragmatism debate. So I think that the conception that the reason to preserve minority opinions is because someday those minority opinions may become majority opinions, right, is one we can use as reflective of this notion that there's a possibility of progress. Okay, there's a second notion. This is somewhat more complex. Is that I think that a second possible tenet of what it means to be modern Orthodox is to believe that the attainment of all the truth that human beings can attain requires both the reason, both the capacity to figure out truth, and revelation. There's some things you can't find, right? You wouldn't know unless God told them to. And that's a very complex position, that you can't know everything, right? You can't just figure out everything by trying to understand what God said, right? Without thinking about whether it's really true, whether your interpretations correspond to something outside it. But you also don't think that if we just had time enough and money enough, we would actually be able to figure out everything in Torah is unnecessary. These are all medieval positions, right? But I'm suggesting that modern Orthodoxy comes out in a very particular place where we don't think that reason is sufficient for truth, but we also don't think that revelation is sufficient for truth. So what I gave you is a second set of sources are places where the Gemara takes this position explicitly. The first one is on Yachid V'Arim al-Chakir Abim, and the Gemara says, look, we have this rule, majority wins, and it says, yeah, we have this rule, majority wins, except when the minority opinion makes more sense. Right? Then we don't have such a rule anymore, right? Majority wins is what happens when you can't make up your mind. And then, to me, one of the climactic moments of Talmud, which I think is deliberate, is when the Talmud asks how we know which things you're supposed to die for, and which things you're not supposed to die before committing. And it says, well, we have a verse that teaches us idolatry, and we have a verse which teaches us that certain kinds of sexual sins called adultery are the same as murder. And the Gemara says, oh yeah, so adultery is the same as murder, but that doesn't help unless you already know that you can't murder people to save a life. And the Gemara says, right, so where's the verse for that? And the Gemara says, verse? Right. Who says your blood is better than his? Which I think is a deliberate point where the Gemara says that there are things you have to be able to understand, which if we have to tell you that, then there's no point. For anybody who has to be told they can't kill somebody to save their own life, right, would have to spell out every single action of their life in advance because they're hopeless as human beings. We could have come up with a verse. We don't want to come up with a verse. Anybody who thinks we need a verse for that will never have any moral self-confidence, and people with no moral self-confidence will never be able to interpret Torah correctly. Now, at the same time, we'll problematize that. The Ketzev Mishnah points out that, there are times when our intuition, seems to break down the other way. What happens if right? What happens if somebody says, give us person X, or we'll kill person X and all of you, right? So then intuition goes the other way, and you have to halakha still one way. So you still have this balance, right? Where the Ketzev Mishnah says that maybe it wasn't really reason. I have to say, I find it a deeply disturbing read of the Gemara to say, they didn't really mean the reason. They had a tradition, but they just presented a reason for as far as it goes. But you should be aware of this, right? That we have this problem that the halakha says that at the core of everything is a svara, and then we don't always paskin the way the svara indicates. Sometimes we do things counterintuitively. I quoted my own thing there on the brain death issue again, which is also related to the issue of progress. So we have this ancient principle, Talmudic already, which says, who says your brother is better than me? So what does it mean? Right, it's a nice intuitive principle. So I wanted to argue, I'm arguing in an article coming out on brain death this year, that actually it has a very specific meaning, which is, right, because we know the halacha, right, on the one hand it says, who says your blood is redder than his, and yet there is a verse which says that, as we interpret it, if two people are walking in the desert, and one of them is holding a canteen of water, he should drink the water. What about the other person? Right, why? Because the verse says, your life comes first. Now, how do we square a fundamental premise that everyone's blood is equal, right, who says your blood is redder than his, with a verse which says your life comes first? Right, so this is obviously a deeply problematic notion. I don't know that anyone has ever come up with a rigorous formulation. So I suggested here that maybe the formulation is that you can never use someone else's life as a means of saving yours. You can choose your life over somebody else's, right? If it's just A or B, you can choose A and not B. But you can't use A to save B. Right? I can't save myself by stepping over you. Right? I can't take you and I'm at a chasm being pursued by cannibals. Right? I can't shoot you and lay you across and walk over you on a bridge if you're not willing to do so voluntarily. For those of you who read Dr. Doolittle as a child, right? You know, maybe the monkeys will come and do it first, but if not, right, you can do it that way. So now, that formulation I get from Immanuel Kant. The categorical imperative is that human beings have to be treated as ends, not means. And maybe it's right. And maybe if it's right, we understand this principle in a way that no one has understood it before. And it has nafkaminas. Right, all sorts of interesting nafkaminas as to whether the Torah applies or not. So I think that a modern Orthodox way of learning Gemara should be open to the possibility that because human knowledge, deeply cautiously, but because we think that human knowledge has the capacity of advancing in other areas, it's possible that the advance in other areas will help us understand Torah better than it has been understood before also. I think, right, and therefore it's a mode of learning Talmud which is open to the possibility of substantive creativity. I think that that it's also possible, I would like to argue, that modern Orthodoxy imposes in one the awareness of the possibility of error. When you understand that what you're producing is part of the interplay of reason and revelation, so then you have to be constantly aware of the possibility of error, and therefore you're much more aware that your own character flaws can lead to distortions of Torah. And I hope that leads to a much deeper suspicion of charisma. I would like it if an unorthodox mode of learning Gemara, right, were one that were deeply suspicious of the capacity of charisma to impose interpretations of Torah. And I gave you the sugya of Elisha ben Avuya, which I think is this wonderful moment where the Gemara considers the possibility of the whole tradition is invalid, because after all, Rabbi Meir learned from Elisha ben Avuya, and Elisha ben Avuya was a horrible person in the context of that sugya, so all whole tradition is gone. So I hope that modern Orthodoxy does that. Overall, positive ways in which this could be played out. I think that on the one hand, we should be alive to the possibilities of anachronism, right? Because really, you know what, knowledge can grow and things like that. We should also be alive, because it's a deeply cautious way, to the term I like to call reverse anachronism. Right? We should not assume that we know things we didn't know. Right? I went into this Rachel the other night. My great examples of this are in the time of Chazal. Right? How do they? Right? Obviously, they couldn't tell time at night, right? Because the way you tell time is by sundials, right? So obviously, in the time of Chazal, they couldn't tell time at night. We all know that, except for the first mission in Brachos, right? Says that you say Shema Abba till the third of the night. Right, a third of the night requires you not only to be able to tell, right, to know exactly how long the night is going to be, and to be able to measure time by that. So obviously they didn't know how to tell time. We just don't know how. Right, so we shouldn't presume that. And my father's example is, when was faster than light communication invented? The answer is when eyes were invented, because we can see each other. But the really cooler answer is the Mishnah says once upon a time what they used to do was light signal fires. Right. Right, speed of light communication. Right, then we had a 1,000-year hiatus because we hadn't developed coding well enough. Right, so people intervened with the message system. But we should be careful about, right. We should be, right. I think that the orthodox part of the modern orthodox sensibility is that we tend to judge the past favorably intellectually, and not presume progress. I believe in the possibility of progress, but not presume progress. Now there are specific areas in which this becomes there are sort of flashpoints of this. One example is how we view the Torah's attitude towards slavery. Right, so you will find, let's say, in Rabbi Lam and Rabbi Navish, the belief that, you know what, we progressed on that. We understand now that slavery is wrong. Well, at the time the Torah was given, they didn't understand it, and the Torah tried to model it. This is a very dangerous idea, right? It plays out in all sorts of things, but I think it's the kind of idea that we should encourage people to be thinking about with great caution. Right? You know, I think that's part of the modern Orthodox mode of learning is to be. The metaphor for this to me is a source which I didn't put on the source sheet because it's not actually Gemara. Maybe it's cheating. It's a Midrash, but I think it's a tremendously important Midrash. I just heard of Benny Lau cited as one of his primary things, which is the Midrash of Daniel the Tailor on this peculiar verse in Kohelet, which says. Zoraiti dimata shukim, I see the tears of the oppressed. Ve'ein lahem menachem, and they have no comforter. U'miyad oshkehem koach, and power flows from the hands of their oppressors. Right, it's very important. It doesn't say in the hands of their oppressors. Power from the hands of their oppressors. Ve'ein lahem menachem, and they have no comforter. And the Midrash says about this that the oppressed are the mamzerim, and the oppressors are the Sanhedrin, and the power is Torah. Now that's a pretty dramatic statement. Now it's not used to wipe Pilchot Mamzerut out of Halacha, but it is used by many great poskim over the ages. And now I've seen in Rav Avadia Yosef Tshuvot, and Rabbi Lau tells a story in which Rav Avadia said this to him over and over again while being Matir a whole set of cases. To me, it represents the willingness to morally challenge the outcome of your Torah study, right? To be aware that you are accountable to some notion. It should always be cautious, right? Because we don't end up. You have to be careful not to reject Torah. But if you understand that the meaning of revelation is always derived through reason, so it means you never have perfect confidence in the outcome. So my suggestion is that if we were to develop a modern Orthodox mode of learning, which I don't think we have yet, so I think first of all there should be multiple modes of learning, and for some people this derech is a tremendously powerful derech, and it has, and even if you don't see it as an end in itself, the brisker derech can make tremendous contributions to understanding. That will aid any other method, right? Because it's just a powerful tool for understanding. But I think we should also perhaps primarily be thinking about a mode of study that encourages these habits of mind, that makes us, right, that is compatible and even encourages a very, very cautious belief in the possibility of the progress of human knowledge, that is aware both of the necessity of reason and of the insufficiency of reason, and that as a result of that is always open to moral self-critique, and therefore sees conversations about ends as a necessary part of the study of Gemara. But it doesn't exist really yet, so I'm just throwing it out as an option, and I'm happy for feedback as to whether you think this is perhaps only the kind of thing should be taught to high school students, only the kind of thing should be taught to adults, only to brilliantly creative people, only to beginners, or whether it offers a viable model for what should characterize our community's learning. And thank you very much again, as always, for listening. Question. Yes, Roger. Malden with all